Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. What kind of man stands behind all of those absolutely captivating canvases? This hour of the program, we are going to be talking about Vincent van Gogh with the co-author of a completely thorough and totally captivating book, it's called Van Gogh, The Life. And it is filled with history and madness and medicine and nature and beauty and school and reading and poetry and sibling relationships. And that's why it's so darned interesting. Our guest is the co-author of this book, Stephen Nafe. He is a Pulitzer Prize winner. He and the co-author of the book won the Pulitzer Prize for Jackson Pollock, An American Saga. He's also Edgar Allan Poe Award finalist in Crime for Final Justice. He was born in Tehran, Iran, to parents who were in the U.S. diplomatic service. His PhD from Harvard School of Arts and Science, and he also has a law degree from Harvard. His undergraduate work was at Princeton, where his major was American history. We'll be welcoming phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@wpr.org. Stephen, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And congratulations on this book. I haven't finished it because it's very long, but I couldn't put it down because it's so interesting on so many levels. The family relationships, which are interesting in themselves, even if he never became anything, an artist, reading about their life in Holland and his relationship with his brother and his mental health and his writing. He is a completely captivating character, isn't he?
This was such an exciting project for us. I mean, it was hard to imagine that the artist who's probably the most popular artist throughout the world, who led this unbelievably interesting life and who left a record so thorough that you could document the evolution of his thinking and the development of his imagination and the incredibly difficult life he led, not only from inside his head because of all the letters he left, but from the world around him because his parents' letters and family letters also existed. We just thought it was an incredible bit of luck that no one had ever yet attempted the big, ambitious book, the one that tried to sort of record the evolution of this extraordinary mind that gave the world these extraordinary paintings.
And let's talk about the family, because it's so beautifully written, your book about the family and how family history was everything. They talked about the family, how the family would parade around the street in Holland where they lived in their good clothing because of the importance of clothing. Family, and it's woven all throughout the story, mother and father and siblings and Theo. How was the family structured? Why was the family crucial to your life?
Well, people sometimes ask us if we have a theory when we go into writing a book, and we really don't about any subject, whether it was Jackson Pollock or Vincent van Gogh. But something we really believe pretty ardently about everyone, not just the people who go on to become famous artists, but all of us, whether we're writers or business people or talk show hosts, or just all of us, are affected by the way we grow up. In fact, Vincent's own mother, Anna Carbentis, said we're shaped first by the family and then by the world. And in the case of someone like Vincent, who had such a difficult childhood and such a difficult relationship with his parents, it was central to what he became. He was basically, I think there are two fundamental ways in which a parent-child relationship can affect motivation and massive ambition, which Vincent certainly had. Unconditional love is the form that most of us would want, and fortunately, most of us get in the form of the kind of ambition a parent tries to instill in a child. But parental disapproval can have sometimes the same effect. And in Vincent's case, the fact that his parents disapproved of him so much throughout his life just spurred him on to try to succeed and got him past one failure after another until in the final couple of years of his life, he created all these great images that we know so well of Starry Nights and Sunflowers and all the rest. The reason he was disliked so much, and the family didn't really understand it early on, they did later, was that his mental illness, it is pretty clear, began at birth, and it turned him early on into a very difficult, petulant, misbehaving, in their word, eccentric child. And the family was unbelievably worried about how they came across to the public. All of Holland in the 19th century was very conventional. But if you were the pastor, the Protestant pastor in a completely Catholic town, which Vincent's father was, you wanted everybody in the town to think that you were upholding all of the conventions of society. And to have this child constantly running off and interacting with the peasants and doing all the things that you weren't supposed to do if you were an upper middle class citizen was just mortifying to the family. And starting with that and then adding all the other things that happened in his life, they just never forgave him.
No. There is this, and it starts very early on in his life and persists through his whole life, and you describe it thoroughly, this intense loneliness. And I look at, here's a kid who's lonely, who's collecting bugs and reading and not very social. And then when he's 11 years old, his parents don't really know what to do with him, so let's cart him off and send him to boarding school, which is probably the worst thing that you could have done.
Absolutely. I mean, the parents thought they were doing the right thing. In fact, one of the things that's so sort of tragic and was that so often they did the wrong thing, but for the right reason. I mean, they hoped that they couldn't, even though he was brilliant. His grades were terrible at school. They tried homeschooling him. That didn't work, so they tried bundling him off. And he was the youngest kid at a small boarding school, completely alienated, so miserable. There's this wonderful scene where his father comes to visit, and he begs to come home, and he sits there in the rain and watches the yellow carriage take his father back to Zinder, where he was born. And it's a memory and an image that's just stamped on his mind until the day he died. But the loneliness was so intense that it was almost like physical pain. There would be months at a time during his adulthood when the only person he interacted with was the waitress at the cafe where he ordered his dinner. And so in addition to all the sort of physical illnesses and the mental illnesses, this emotional and personal isolation was almost as big of an injury as his physical ailments and his mental illness. I think we just can't even comprehend the loneliness that he experienced. And it's one of the reasons why, despite his behavior, the reaction to the book has been virtually everything we could possibly have hoped. But occasionally somebody will say that they wonder if we liked our subject, and it's a funny question, because when you write about somebody, they almost become like a member of your family. Whether you like them or not isn't the question in your mind. It's trying to understand them. And we actually it was hard not to feel sympathy for Vincent, even when he was demanding more money from Theo or doing one of the many things that could annoy people. Anyone who could live this difficult life, who was probably bipolar. He definitely had epilepsy. He was malnourished. He was and almost above all else, he was so lonely. The fact that he could pick himself up every morning and get through the day, and not only just exist, but finally produce some of the most joyful images ever created by
right.
mankind,
is
so uplifting and so admirable that our admiration for him far exceeds our recognition that he might not have been the guy you'd want to spend the weekend with.
Exactly. He was brilliant. He read, he talks, and you talk early on about everything he does with the urgent, blinding, single-mindedness of a child. He even read the newspaper in a fury. He read books. He was speaking a lot of language. He was mastering the interactions of color. Everything was just so intense, and so, and he was smart, so he could take it all in and learn it very quickly.
And had almost a photographic memory. It's so hard for us who have access to books and to the internet to realize that if you were in the 19th century and you wanted to remember what a painting looked like, especially in color, you had to remember it in your head. And he would, he had a literally a photographic memory. He could remember, we know this because he describes them in his letters decades later. If he went to a museum and saw a painting by Rembrandt, 20 years later, he could describe a passage of the of paint, or the way light crossed an object, or the shift from one tone of color to another. And he had the same photographic memory for the literature that he read. And as you say, he read in multiple languages. He read English, French, German, and Dutch. And because he was so alienated, he had about 5 hours a day after whatever his work was to read. And he would pick one book or one play or one poem by an author and then just read everything. He read Shakespeare, all of it, repeatedly throughout his life. He read all of Dickens repeatedly. He read the great German Romantic poets repeatedly. And he experienced, why this is so important is that he experienced life in a kind of layered way. When he would go into a church and see an old woman and a child praying, he didn't just experience that moment in time. He would immediately begin imagining paintings of that subject, or novels or poems that depicted that subject. And so his mind was just sort of throbbing with metaphor and with images. And that's one of the things that makes those paintings that are so richly colored and so beautiful also just resonate with deeper meaning.
Oh, that's interesting. So we see all that, even though we may not be aware of what those other paintings or poems were, we see it in his painting?
Yes, I mean, and I think you don't, although I think the book will help people, we've been told, that it'll enrich an experience of the paintings, but because he wanted everybody to understand these paintings, often these metaphors are completely straightforward. Even though he sort of opened or ushered the world into a new form of art, he was still firmly rooted in his Victorian time and his Victorian sensibility. And some of the images that he liked most were the sort of English illustrations in the magazines that had very, very simple, straightforward metaphors. The one example I could give is there was a very famous illustration when Dickens died, and Dickens was the most popular writer of his era in England, and it was a huge there was a massive sadness in England when he died, and there was an illustrator who did a picture of Dickens' study where he wrote his books, and there's his desk, and the chair, the empty chair, is pulled away from the desk, and the image is called The Empty Chair, and the message is that Dickens will never sit in this chair again, and he will never write another novel, and will never be able to experience his great imagination again. It's not a complex philosophical statement, it's a kind of gut-wrenching metaphor, and Vincent used that twice in two paintings of chairs. When Gauguin left the Yellow House in 1888, I believe it was, he painted a portrait of Gauguin, but instead of painting the man, he painted the chair that Vincent had bought for him, and he has an extinguished candle sitting on the chair. So you don't have to have a PhD in philosophy or art history to see that chair and to see that extinguished candle and to see the powerful statement it is about the loneliness we feel when people that are important to us leave our lives.
Right. Tell us the story, too, because it goes back to when we were talking about his complete and utter loneliness. It was a moment of great poignancy when you wrote at great length about his anticipation of Gauguin's coming to the Yellow House. And
yes, I mean, it is so sad, and yet so. I mean, that's what people. One of the comments that we are most gratified by is when people say the book reads like a big 19th century novel.
Yes,
and
it does.
Even though it's long, we've been told that it reads really quickly, and it's because Greg, who does the writing, really is a literary writer. I mean, he writes like a novelist, and even though everything is factual and it's all the sourcing is there online, all 28,000 footnotes, so there's not a detail that it doesn't come from a specific and credible source, but it's all woven into this story, and there is this incredibly a poignant moment where he's been begging Theo to arrange to get Theo, his younger brother, who is his sponsor, to get Gauguin to come to Arles. He would have taken anyone. Gauguin wasn't his first choice.
Oh.
He just wanted somebody.
Oh.
And Theo was only able to get Gauguin to go to Arles by bribing him. He paid him 150 francs a month to move there. And there are these, they barely knew each other. It wasn't as if he was begging for an old friend to come live with him. He just wanted another artist so they could set up an artist community and perhaps attract other artists and go out and paint together. And he had this illusion that somehow this would both improve his art and solve his need for companionship. And the minute, because of the sort of the personality traits that come with this form of epilepsy untreated, he was so difficult to be with that the minute Gauguin arrives in Arles, he starts writing his friends back in Paris saying, I got to get out of here. And 2 months later, he finally did, and it was that was the night that Vincent cut his ear off, and mm-hmm. It was one of the triggering factors for that world-famous episode.
Yeah. It's interesting that all these people weave their way back into Van Gogh's life, though, even though you would think an event like that was, I'm done with this guy forever, but it's not the case. We have to go all over the place in the book, but let's jump ahead to when and how Van Gogh becomes a star.
Yeah, I think one of the revelations, aside from the really famous one that got us on television in England,
60 Minutes,
live,
yeah,
and six times in one day and had 700 articles, namely the death, there are other things that will surprise people. One is the one that you mentioned that's so important, and that is what a great reader he was. One of the sort of surprising things is we all think that he had no success during his lifetime, that he never sold a painting. He actually did sell one painting in the last year of his life, but it was and for not inconsiderable amount of money. It was about $1,200 in today's money, but it was to the sister of somebody he knew, so it wasn't really an arm's length sale. But what did happen, and this I think will come as a surprise to people, is that there was a young symbolist poet in Paris, and Impressionism had come and sort of was waning, and even some of the post-impressionist figures were no longer the sort of the newest thing in town, and the symbolists were working very hard to make symbolism the sort of new chic movement. And one of these poets, what the symbolists believed was that the world that you experience is reality. The world that you see, the world that the impressionists painted, was less real than the world that you feel. And this guy hears about this crazy Dutchman down in an insane asylum of all things in southern France, who lived life so intensely that he actually cut his ear off, is making these wild and crazy looking paintings, and he goes and sees some of them at a shop in Paris, and he reads some letters from some artists who knew Vincent, and he writes this unbelievable, very long article for a really prominent paper in which he makes the unbelievable, outrageous claim that the greatest living artist in the world is this relatively unknown, crazy Dutchman in this insane asylum named Vincent van Gogh.
My.
And so this happened in January of 1890, the year he died. And so about 7 months before he died, everybody in Paris is reading about this Dutch artist, and his brother Theo sent some of his paintings a couple months later to an exhibition in Brussels, and even as important a painter as Claude Monet saw some of Vincent's paintings and said, you know, what this person is doing is really interesting. So he actually was just on the verge of becoming famous the year he died.
But he also, it all weaves its way together, doesn't it? The beginning, the middle, and the end.
Yeah.
Feared that he would be punished for this article.
Absolutely. You're so right. One of the ways that he tried to console himself during his decades of failure was by believing that people who achieve success are punished for their success, mm-hmm. that somehow he was better off being a failure because successful people reap an avalanche of misery from their success. It was a delusional idea, but it helped console him in his failure. So all of a sudden, he gets a copy of this article from Paris, and you know, there's part of him, human after all, who's that is unbelievably pleased that somebody is recognizing him, but then he immediately reacts and thinks, my gosh, if my life has been this miserable so far, and if success makes you even more miserable, how am I going to handle the level of misery if I'm actually a success? It was the kind of thinking that's irrational, but he was sitting in an insane asylum when he went through these thought processes. So, but it's a very, I think people will be surprised both by the fact that he did begin to become a little bit famous just before he died,
yes.
and that he reacted in this really confounded, he was just astonished and really didn't know what to make of it.
We'll start taking phone calls in just a moment here. Let me give you our phone number. We're talking about the wonderful biography of Van Gogh, The Life. The co-author, Stephen Nafee, is with us. And here is our number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email, if you want to use that, is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Stephen, and let's start with Daryl in Couderay. Hi, Daryl.
Hi, Kathleen and your guest.
Hi.
Thank you so much for the program.
Sure.
I had a question and a comment. Was Van Gogh's last known painting The Blackbirds in the Hill? And also, my favorite song is Starry, Starry Night by Don McLean.
That's coming up, part of it, at the end of the show. We thought of it, too. Stephen?
Well, it's a really good question, Daryl. For a long time, it was believed that the last painting that Vincent painted was The Crows in the Wheatfield. And it was in the great 50s film with Kirk Douglas. It shows him painting that painting when a swarm of crows come surround him almost in tippy-hedron birds-like fashion, and he pulls out the gun and shoots himself. Well, it turns out that painting was actually, and it sort of fit the mythology that Irving Stone was developing, because that painting can be interpreted, at least on one level, as a meditation on death because of the sort of somberness of these crows and this path, this divergent path in the wheat field where you know life can take two different directions, is part of the obvious metaphorical meaning of that somber painting. But it turns out that painting was painted about July 10th, and he didn't die for more than 2 weeks, and he painted a lot of very happy paintings in between that. Kathleen, if you want me to address the death, maybe this is the time to do it.
Go right ahead, Stephen.
People ask us, you know, did we come up with this alternative theory of how he died before we started the book? And the answer is clearly no. It happened over a long period of time, and early in the process, we began to see things. in the literature that made it clear that the original explanation, as it appeared in the fictionalized accounts of Irving Stone, it was just problematic. I mean, the fact that that painting wasn't the last painting is just one example, but by no means the major one. The fact that he was shot in the abdomen, and that the medical report showed that he was shot from too far out and from an unusual angle, and very few people who kill themselves with a gun shoot themselves there. It's a long, lingering, painful death. It's less than 2%. That seemed really odd. It seemed even more strange that anyone would have given him a gun. The argument was that he was given the gun to scare off the crows, but there were no crows in July in Auvers, and he was a bird lover from child. Kathleen, you mentioned that he would he studied insects, but he also studied birds when he was a child. He was a bird lover. He didn't need to see a bird in order to put it in a painting. And who would have given this crazy Dutchman who had just come out of a insane asylum a gun? That just didn't make any sense, and the gun was never found. It also didn't make sense that he could have climbed the mile down the escarpment from the wheat fields down to the inn with his terrible wound in his belly. And we also, when you spend as much time as you spend with the subject of a book like this year after year, you get inside his head, and we knew that what his attitude towards suicide was. He railed against it regularly, and in fact, one of our friends at the Van Gogh Museum, after we'd sort of come up with this alternative theory, said that he never believed Vincent had shot himself because it just didn't feel right after having spent, in his case, 15 years studying Vincent's letters. And then some new details begin to emerge that suggest that there is possibly another explanation. In the 1950s, after Lust for Life came out, a man named René Secretin, who was a prominent businessman and banker, came forward to give this remarkable interview in which he doesn't admit shooting Vincent van Gogh, but he admits all kinds of terrible behavior when he was a 16-year-old child or boy in Auvers, wearing a Buffalo Bill costume that he bought at the fair in Paris the year before. He was basically playing cowboy and Indian all summer, and he had a pistol that, as he put it, went off when it felt like it. It was a malfunctioning pistol, and he used it to occasionally shoot squirrels and rabbits and whatever. And he admits to torturing Vincent in the way that lots of boys tortured this strange guy when they came across him and wherever he lived as an adult. They put salt in his coffee, put a snake in his paint box. Because he knew that Vincent was lonely, he had his girlfriend sort of flirt with him and toy with him. And very importantly, he and his brother got Vincent drunk with some frequency at one of the poachers' bars along the Oise River there in Auvers. And the only witness to the shooting later claimed that Vincent was not shot in the wheat fields, but was shot in one of the farmyards along the Rue Boucher, which is very near the poacher's bar where the Secretan boys would take Vincent to get something to drink. And in this late 1950s interview, Secretan admits that the gun was his gun. The further detail that was really sort of the clincher for us that made this alternate theory sound at the very least more plausible than the existing theory is that John Rewald, the greatest historian of Impressionism and Post-Impressionism, was in France in the 1930s, and he was studying art at the Sorbonne in Paris, but he would take trips occasionally up to Auvers, and when he was doing this, there were people who were still alive who had been adults when Vincent died, and the rumors he heard were quite specific, and they were that Vincent had not committed suicide, that he was shot accidentally by a couple of boys, and he decided to take the blame in order not to ruin their lives. So you take all those details together, both the details about the Secretan brothers and the sort of complications with the original theory, and all we say in an appendix to the book is, and we felt it was our obligation as biographers to make this information known. It turns out afterwards we were hardly the first people to think this, but to make it known that we think that there this alternate explanation is at least more plausible than the suicide. And I would say about 90% of the major reviews of our book have agreed that this alternate explanation is more plausible, and about the same percentage of the museum curators at the museums that we've been speaking at about the book believe it too. And in some ways, even though it's not as dramatic an ending to his life as the great Kirk Douglas moment in Lust for Life, there, as a number of people have said in articles and in blogs, it's the kind of act of generosity. You know, saving these two boys from the consequences of their own misbehavior so that their lives are not ruined by this accident is such an act of generosity that it really rounds out and ends Vincent's life on this sort of grace note of generosity that I think is in some ways much more touching than a suicide.
Did he have, knowing his complete life as you do, nobody else on earth knows it as well as you do, did he have a pattern in his life of treating his tormentors, his many tormentors, with such utter acts of kindness?
He would get angry, and we think there was some sort of altercation in that farmyard. Mm. When they would, for instance, boys would spit on him, or would spit on his drawings, or would take his paint tubes and grab them and throw them on the ground and stomp on them, and he would scream and shout. But the other act of kindness, what I would relate it to, is what I would consider to be another revelation in the book, and that is why did he leave Paris in 1886? When he was living with Theo, you know, we've talked so much about his loneliness. He wanted all of his adult life to live with Theo, and finally, in 1886, he just makes it happen. He just shows up unannounced and uninvited, and to Theo's consternation, they had a rough patch for a while. But they finally got to the point where they were living together pretty amicably. It was certainly the happiest time of Vincent's life, and all of a sudden, in 1888, he just packs his bags and leaves for Arles. There's no good explanation of why he did this, and we discern from something he wrote in a letter to his sister Will that he did this because he knew his living with Theo was unhealthy for Theo. Theo had syphilis, as Vincent did, only Theo's syphilis was far more advanced, and he was really quite ill. And we feel strongly, based on this letter to Will, that Vincent, did this unbelievably sacrificial thing to leave the one happy companionship that he ever experienced as an adult and go off and live by himself in Arles because he knew it would help Theo. And we think that at the end, when he was by accepting this death, he was not only protecting these two boys, he was also achieving the end of misery that he couldn't achieve on his own because he couldn't kill himself. But even more importantly, as Theo was growing sicker and sicker, he now had a wife and a young child. This was in Vincent's mind, we think very strongly, he believed that by leaving this earth, he was taking a huge burden off the shoulders of Theo, who was already much too burdened by obligations,
baby,
to the people around
sickness.
Him and his illness.
Yeah. Let's go to Solia from Viroqua. Hi, Solia.
Sonia, thank you
Sonia.
Very much.
Hi, Sonia.
I'm always amazed when someone comes up with a new biography of someone who's been dead for so long. And I wonder if you could take a minute to explain where the new material comes from. How did you find, or what did you do to find so much new material that has not been published?
Found that it's a terrific question, Sylvia. One of the things we were afraid, because we'd worked on Jackson Pollock, who died when we began in 1981, just a couple of decades before, and therefore we could go and talk to his wife and to his brothers, and it was easy, comparatively easy, to find new material. When you're dealing with somebody who died so long ago, you know, you can't go find somebody who knew him. So all of the new material had to be hiding in plain sight. Basically, much of it was in the Van Gogh Museum archives, which very few people had went through. In fact, no one that we know of had gone through consistently from folder to folder, every single folder. But also, if you're an art historian and you're writing a dissertation or an academic article or even a book, you know, you only have a year or less, or at most a couple of years, to work on a project, and you have to sort of limit what you're reading, because there's just this massive library of materials on Vincent, much of it brilliant and some of it pretty mediocre. But if you're trying to write the definitive biography, you force yourself to read everything, whether it's brilliant or whether it's mediocre, and some of these things, some of the most important evidence appeared in really mediocre newspaper articles or books that we may have been among the very few people who read them. That's why I also say that other people had put together pieces of the information but had not put the whole thing together on the death, for example. One scholar at the Van Gogh Museum in 2006 read the medical report and about the wound, about the gunshot coming from too far out and from this odd angle, and argued to his colleagues that Vincent couldn't have shot himself because of the trajectory of the bullet, but he just couldn't imagine who would have shot Vincent Van Gogh. But he was unaware of both the Secretan interview and of the John Rewald reports from Auvers. So only if you went out there, as we were able to do, because two of us spent 10 years doing this, and I don't want to compare myself to Vincent, but one thing we do share in common is I read very quickly. So I was reading as many as 3 books a day.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, you don't read them carefully, and you don't read them enjoyably, because you're reading them for the specific purpose. It was really painful, because some of these were books I'd never read before, and I wanted to luxuriate in Zola, for example, but I only had the time to read Zola for what impact it might have had on Vincent Van Gogh. So for year after year, you have the two of us reading this massive amount of material. And I think I'm not bragging. We were less lucky that we were in this position where we could spend this much time doing nothing but reading the entire, or virtually the entire corpus of materials, not just on Vincent, but also all the books he read. We felt you couldn't really understand him unless you read all the books he read. So it was this massive,
what a massive project. Oh my gosh!
And so you can imagine. I don't think it is a blemish on anybody else's reputation that since they were not setting themselves up to write the big ambitious definitive biography, they didn't read all of these obscure materials, many of them uninteresting. I mean, to find those nuggets, you had to read a whole lot of mediocre stuff that didn't provide any information of any value.
We're talking with the co-author of Van Gogh, The Life, this hour of our program, Stephen Nafe. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. And we'll continue our conversation in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have some emails that have come in. Here's a good one. Many people will identify with this. This is from Rich in Rhinelander, who thanks us for the program on Van Gogh. As a student at UW-Madison in the 60s, I made friends with a crew of New Yorkers. One friend invited me to visit his family over a break, took me to the Guggenheim, and Vincent Van Gogh was exhibited. I remember standing breathless in that spiral of the Guggenheim, light flooding in over the top of me and the art on display, the posters in dorm rooms. museums at UW included many knockoff prints of sunflowers, but standing before the art itself, I could not believe the difference between the prints and the actual work. There's no way of describing the sensation of that visual hitting the brain of a young man, me, Green, out of Wisconsin.
Well, I think that's a wonderful wonderful description of how powerful these paintings are. It really is hard to imagine any other artist, no matter how glorious, who has this much of an impact on so many people of all ages and from all parts of the world, whether it's New York or Wisconsin or
Japan,
Cambodia, or Namibia or anywhere, but you can, and it has to do with the intelligence of them, the incredible intensity of the color and the genius of the color combinations, those wonderful simple metaphors, the sheer jubilation and joy of those images, and the exquisite thick brushwork just overpowers you. I think it's one reason why they're so much more powerful in person than they are in prints, is that you just, when you're looking at a color reproduction, you don't see that unbelievable buildup of paint that's so physical and so just so intense. And it's one of the great questions we constantly ask ourselves: is why does this guy have this impact that's so much more visceral than the other great masters of art, Rembrandt or even Michelangelo? And I think the sheer physicality of those images and the color is one of the things. There are some other things. One of them is that even before you read our book or have read read his letters and know just how difficult his life was, I think the average person, both from the accepted earlier accepted notion of the suicide, but certainly from the cutting off of the ear, and even from the sadness in all of those many self-portraits, people have a sort of basic understanding that this was a guy whose life didn't work out very well. And the idea that somebody whose life didn't work out very well could somehow summon from this deep well of sorrow that was his life these jubilant images has a kind of inspirational quality that's really powerful for all of us when we see those images. Mm-hmm. And I think very few people articulated as well as your caller, the person who sent in the email did. But I think the people are just are overwhelmed when they see some of these paintings for the first time in the flesh.
I was interested in your interview on 60 Minutes when you talked about the Japanese visitors who bring the ashes of their ancestors to the grave of Van Gogh, and I didn't know Theo's grave was right next to his. Why do they do that?
Well, it's very touching. Theo's wife, Joanna Bonger, is one of the unsung heroes of this whole story. Theo kept the letters, thank God, and the paintings. But Joanna, who was a professional translator, was the first person to translate Vincent's letters into English, and she did an exquisite job. She was really a first-rate translator, and we're all indebted to that, and the fact that she also released the paintings onto the market in a very careful way that helped build his reputation. But she also, because she remarried, she was only married to Theo for about a year and a half. He died soon after they were married, leaving her with this young child to raise. She got remarried, and that man died actually rather soon after her marriage. And therefore, even though Theo had been buried outside of Utrecht, she had his body exhumed and taken to Auvers and buried next to his brother Vincent. So it's really really powerful to stand there in front of the graves and see these two brothers who meant so much to each other lying there next to each other in this cemetery. And it's all the more powerful because the gravestones are extremely simple, and they just read, here rests Vincent Van Gogh and here rests Theo Van Gogh. This graveyard attracts about 500,000 visitors a year. It's hard to imagine any cultural figure other than sort of a pop star who attracts that kind of attention. And people bring mementos. They bring little notes. Artists will bring paintbrushes. Russians will pour vodka over the graves. Jewish visitors will put stones or rocks on the headstones, which is that tradition. But the one that's most overwhelming is that Japanese visitors have been known to bring urns with the ashes of their ancestors to pour on the grave so that they can spend eternity with the painter of Starry Night.
That
gives you, when I talk about a kind of unique, visceral reaction to this artist and what he did for the world, gives you an indication of just how extraordinary this thing is.
Yeah. Shelley in Westfield, hi.
Hi. This question is was addressed a little bit by a previous caller who asked why and how there was so much material that hadn't been discovered before. And I was watching your wonderful interview on Charlie Rose where you mentioned stepping into the Van Gogh Museum speaking no Dutch. How did you deal with all the translation that had to be done?
Shelley, it was overwhelming. If there were times we wondered about our own sanity in taking on this project, and at the incredible generosity of the people at the Van Gogh Museum for treating us so well, despite the fact that we'd won a Pulitzer on Pollock helped a lot, but we did not speak Dutch. What it meant was the archivists, and they have these wonderful people. This one woman named Fika Pabst, who's been there for 40 years, has become a really close friend, and they would just hand us folder after folder of materials, many of which had never been looked through before, and we just Xeroxed everything. We just stood there at the photocopier for months on end, and then had it all shipped back to America. And then we had 11 Dutch translators, two of whom were central, and because we would have to sit there with these documents, and they would have to explain to us what was in the document, and we would decide based on their explanation whether to have it translated or not. So we would pick out the documents or the paragraphs of the documents that seemed crucial, and we would send those off digitally to a translator, and they would come back to us in English. And it was this massive translation project. Luckily, we both have a passable knowledge of French, and that meant that we could read the French materials, most of them ourselves. But it was the biggest obstacle, no doubt, was aside from the sheer volume of material on Vincent van Gogh, was the fact that we didn't speak his primary language. We have enormous gratitude for the 11 people who helped us get past that that obstacle.
Thank goodness all of these people wrote so many letters.
Absolutely, and we do wonder what's going to happen in the future, now that our correspondence or our interactions are either over the telephone or in text messages or in emails that will be gradually lost, will it be possible to recreate a life of somebody living today the way that we were able to recreate Vincent's life? Although even for somebody in the 19th century, when people were writing voluminously, it's something of a little miracle that Theo was both sentimental enough of a pack rat that he kept all these letters, and he folded them carefully, and he tied bundles of them with red ribbons and put them in this wardrobe. And not just Vincent's letters, but also the family letters. We would not have had this extraordinary opportunity to get inside Vincent's head if it hadn't been for Theo's incredible act in safeguarding those letters, and then Yo and her son, also named Vincent, keeping them safe in the years to come. And of course, now they're they're international treasures in the vaults of the Van Gogh Museum.
Mm. It must be a good feeling to have him inside you to the extent that he must be inside you for the rest of your life.
Yes, you do. In fact, people ask, was it worth it? Because it was so, it was, you know, 7 days a week, 10, 14 hours a day, 10 years. And among the things that made it worth it was we met when we were in Amsterdam a couple months ago giving some talks about 10 of Theo's great-grandchildren.
Oh, how wonderful.
It was so wonderful. One woman, this lovely lady, came up after one of the events and hugged me and kissed me with tears in her eyes and thanked Greg and me for writing this book and helping them connect to their ancestors in this way. And you do feel this connection. As I said to them, I know their ancestors so much better than I know my own, that it was like meeting distant cousins, and they felt the same way. You do, I mean, to have sort of spent, I mean, not that either person was an easy or uncomplicated person, but both Pollock and Van Gogh were so extraordinary, and what they did was so extraordinary. It is a gift to have spent 10 years with each one of them.
Well, it's a gift to us for your book, too. The book is Van Gogh, The Life. It has recently been published. Stephen Nafe is the co-author and our guest this hour. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, Chrissy Pease for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Thanks for all of your calls. The book is worth a read.
In colors on the snowy linen land. Now I understand what you tried to say to me. How you suffered for your sanity, and how you tried to set them free. They would not listen, they did not know how. Perhaps they'll listen now.